I think there's a few questions still from before the break, so yeah.
Can objects be imprinted with karma, like blood money or an engagement ring you buy?
Objects imprinted by karma.
The notion of blood money, you know, yeah. Something that was.
I mean, of course, yeah, I mean, of course, I mean, I think imprinted by karma is probably not the right word for that, because karma is personal to us. It's in terms of our behavior and then the results of that in terms of our experiences. So, of course, then there are other people and other things associated with all of our actions, and so there is obviously that association. So, you know, if you steal money, then that money is gained through unethical means. So then to use that money for your own welfare or so would also be unethical as well, of course.
I'm a little confused on a thoughts part of the background.
Sure.
Like sometimes you don't have control over what pops into your head. So how can that, if it's negative and you're like, oh, wow, that was a negative thought, how can that create an
impact? Yeah. Well, I think I want to leave that because it's going to be answered in one of the presentations coming soon. So it'll be answered.
Okay, so that's the idea of so stealing money, and then in a later life, somebody steals money from you. Which is like
Later life. I mean, one of the next presentations also is that the result could happen next week, next month, next year, next life, or.
Okay.
So again, that's coming in the presentation. So maybe we can hold off on the questions because it seems like a lot of these questions are things that I haven't covered yet, unless it's something we've already covered. Yeah.
Just curious, the existence of karma, since it's a law of cause and effect, does that mean it's a permanent phenomenon?
Permanent. No, because actions, imprints, and results, they're always changing. Permanent means not changing from one moment to the next.
Okay. So an individual's karma is always changing.
Yeah, it's all, of
so
course.
That's impermanent.
Of course. And that's one of the things that we're going to see in the next presentation, actually. So let's go to the next presentation. So what we can do now then is have a look at we can go back to the page 12, the start of the presentation. And the first outline there is reflecting on karma and its effects in general. So here we can talk about the general principles of karma. And here we see four things mentioned. The first one, it says, the certainty of karma. And we can say that karma is certain or definite in terms of the result is always similar type to the cause. So here we can use the analogy of the physical world. We see in the physical world the law of cause and effect operating. And that law of cause and effect in the physical world is operating with certain general principles. And one of those, of course, is that the result is always similar type to the cause. Meaning if you plant an apple seed, you always get apple tree. Orange seed, always orange tree. So the result is always similar type to the cause in the physical world. Likewise, in the law of cause and effect in the mental world, in karma, the same thing applies. Is that if you do a non-virtuous action, you always get suffering result. You do virtuous action, you always get happiness result. So the result is always the similar type to the cause. This is what certainty means. The second one here talks about magnification or increase of karma. And as with the physical world, if you plant a small seed, you can end up with a big tree. Likewise, if you plant a small seed of an action in the mind, you can end up with a big result. Like the physical world, if you put the seed in the ground and then you nurture that with fertilizer and warmth and water and so forth, then you can end up with a big tree. Likewise, if you plant a small seed in the mind and you nurture that by being happy about doing it again and again and again and again, you can end up with a big result. So the same idea here. That's increase. Then the third one says, not experiencing the effects of actions that you did not do. So that basically is not done, no result. Meaning that you can't have a result without a cause. As with the physical world, you can't get an apple tree without planting the apple seed. It doesn't just magically appear. Similarly, you can't experience the result if you didn't create the cause. So I think this is fairly obvious. Then the third one is actions you have done do not perish. Which means not wasted. Again, the analogy. If you plant an apple seed in the ground, there's definitely an apple seed in the ground. It's not like sometimes you plant the seed and it just disappears. Likewise, here, if you do an action with motivation, definitely an imprint is planted in the mind. It's not like some actions disappear in space. Of course, as with the physical world, even though there's definitely a seed in the ground, then it's not fixed what's going to happen to that seed. Likewise, even though we do an action, definitely is an imprint in the mind, it's not fixed what the result is going to be. So, like the seed in the ground, you can do a number of different things. You can either nurture it, give it a lot of fertilizer and soil, warmth and water and so forth, and then you can get a big result. Or, if you don't give it much water or so forth, maybe you end up with a small result. Or if you give it no water or you put poison in the ground, you get no result. But there's still seed there. So likewise here, in our actions, if we do an action, definitely imprint in the mind. If we nurture that by being happy about it, doing it again and again and again, we can get a big result. If we don't do that, maybe smaller result. Or if we don't nurture it and we can damage it by regretting it and so forth, then we can end up with no result, but not wasted. There's still an imprint in the mind. So we can affect the imprint, either making it grow or damaging it so it never ripens. So this brings in the whole idea then of purification in Buddhism. And that's going to come up later in the text here, but actually since we're talking about it now, I want to bring it in now. Because here, at this level of trying to make our life meaningful, then we want to strive for a good future, a future that does not involve suffering. And so suffering, of course, comes from harmful, non-virtuous behaviour. So if we've done harmful, non-virtuous behaviour, then, of course, we don't want to experience the result. So what can we do? We can purify our mind of these negative imprints, negative habits. How can we do that effectively? It is described in over the page, on page 14, halfway down the bottom, towards the bottom actually, it says, in particular, the way of purification through the four powers. So that's what I'd like to talk about now. Before I do that, any questions about any of these four principles?
My question is about principle three, not done, no result, and connecting that to karma is personal. Mm-hmm. And I think, I'm guessing this will become more clear, but just to put it out there for now, this idea that are we leading people get what they deserve?
No. To answer that, part of the answer is going to come in this presentation here. No.
Good.
No. Okay. But that's coming.
Okay.
Okay. So how can we effectively purify our mind of negative imprints and negative habits? So here we have a presentation called the Four Opponent Powers. These are four things that we can do to purify our mind of these negative imprints and negative habits. So here they're listed in a little bit different order, but normally the way they're listed, the first one is, the first one is listed in the same order. Here it's called the power of eradication. Normally this is listed as the power of regret. So therefore, one way we can begin to purify any negative habits or negative actions is to have sincere regret for having done that behavior. But here, of course, we need to distinguish between regret and guilt. Big difference. Because the correct perspective, of course, is I have done a bad or harmful negative behavior or action. So this is the correct perspective, to acknowledge simply I have done a bad action or harmful behavior. However, we often don't have this perspective. And often, if we've done a harmful negative behavior, instead of having this perspective, we simply think or say, I am a bad person. So what we've done here, of course, is we have fused our behavior to the person. This, in psychology, is called cognitive fusion. It's a false perspective. Wrong perspective, because there are two things here. There's the person and their behavior. The problem is, of course, is if we fuse them together, and cognitive means to mentally do that, if we mentally fuse them together and see, I am a bad person, then we're in trouble. Because if we see ourselves as a bad person, then often what we do, of course, is then we beat ourselves up. And often that leads, of course, to low self-esteem. We attack ourselves, and this is the basis for guilt. Because if we've done something harmful and we feel guilty, what are we focusing on? Bad me. So guilt comes from cognitive fusion, which is a completely wrong, invalid perspective. And with that comes often low self-esteem, attacking ourselves, self-hatred, and of course with this, we feel stuck. And Also, the problem with this is now we've simply identified ourselves as a bad person, which means it becomes almost impossible to acknowledge any of our good behavior, because bad people don't do good things. So then we block the fact that we actually sometimes do good things. So we have a completely unbalanced view of ourselves. We're only seeing ourselves as a bad person. So, of course, this is just not helpful at all. I mean, it's a wrong perspective, and it just paralyzes us and makes us feel bad, and we're just stuck. So, of course, the solution is to simply stop doing cognitive fusion, because it's a wrong perspective. Instead of seeing ourselves as a bad person, we simply acknowledge, I have done a bad action. Then, instead of having guilt towards ourselves, if we see I have done a bad action, then we can regret the behavior. Because if we regret, what are we focusing on? The action. So we can have regret for the action. We can have forgiveness and compassion for ourselves. And we can look at ways of overcoming that negative behavior. So we can have still good self-esteem, and then by having regret, then that will be directing at the action. We can look at ways of overcoming that negative behavior. If we do the cognitive fusion, then it becomes very difficult, if not impossible, to have forgiveness and compassion for ourselves. Because trying to have forgiveness and compassion for a bad person feels like what we're saying is, that's okay, that bad behavior, I forgive the bad behavior. Of course, we should not be compassionate to the bad behavior. So if we see ourselves as a bad person, then it sometimes doesn't feel right even to have forgiveness for ourselves. I don't deserve forgiveness or compassion because I'm a bad person. But that only comes from cognitive fusion. So what we need to do is to stop doing that. And then we can correctly have forgiveness and compassion for the person, but at the same time, of course, not accept our bad behavior, regret our bad behavior, and look at ways of overcoming our bad behavior. So, unfortunately, this is epidemic in our modern society. We, unfortunately, tend to grow up in this way of thinking and speaking. I mean, how often do you see in a family, if a young child is misbehaving, the parent goes, bad girl, bad boy. I mean, it's a disaster. And then, of course, to try and overcome that, then the parent goes, oh, later that, you're special. This is also a disaster. Because one is that then the child identifies themselves as a special person, which, of course, they can never live up to, and then they're in a big dilemma. And then, of course, if we identify ourselves as special, then, of course, there's a big danger of thinking where we really are special, we are better than everyone else. And so we get this arrogant attitude, thinking we're superior to others. So this is not a good way to go either. So, therefore, it comes with, in this, we looked at before, look at later, the idea of praising. We should never praise people. Praise their behavior. If you praise the person and say, you're a wonderful person, there's a chance then they'll go, oh, yes, I am, aren't I? And then either one thing will happen is that they'll get a puffed up mind thinking they're superior, or when later they fail to live up to that label, then they're going to be depressed. So either way, it's not helpful. What? Because then what you should do is praise their behavior, and we must praise their behavior. If someone is in doing a virtuous behavior, we must praise their behavior, because if we praise their behavior, that will hopefully inspire them to continue to do the good behavior. Whereas if we praise the person, we're not addressing the behavior, then they just get puffed up mind. So on both sides, whether it's negative or positive, or ourselves or others, then if we do cognitive fusion, we're really in trouble. We're really going to have a lot of problems with ourselves and others. And unfortunately, this has really been drilled into us in our life, in our modern society. And unfortunately, I think this guilt thing has been used by society and unfortunately also religion as a way of having power over people. The guilt trip. It doesn't help at all. It just paralyzes us, makes us feel bad. It doesn't even look at the negative behavior and how to overcome it. So it's completely useless. We don't need to feel guilty about anything. Instead, rather, if we've done some negative behavior, then to have this regret. Any questions?
I always thought a guilt or guilty feeling went along with no real intention to change the behavior. But now I see it's more a matter of it's very difficult or impossible to change the behavior because it's congruent with who we think we are.
Exactly. That's us. I mean, how often do we hear people say, I'm just an angry person, that's me. No? True? No hope. I'm an angry person. People tell me, I believe it, I'm an angry person.
That's also a way of not taking responsibility.
Exactly. Exactly. Exactly.
Can't do anything about it.
Can't do anything about it, that's it. That's the state of affairs. Sorry. Really, it is. Also a way of absolving responsibility. You know, that's just me, that's it, no hope. Whereas if we do the correct thing, then we have responsibility, you know. Because either we are our behavior or we have behavior. Mm-hmm. Are we our behavior or do we have certain behavior? We have behavior. Are we our thoughts or do we have thoughts? We have thoughts. Are we our emotions or do we have emotions? We have emotions. Are we our personality or do we have a personality? These are all things which we have. They're not us. If we identify ourselves with our thoughts, emotions, memories, habits, personalities, we're in trouble. If we identify on the negative or the positive, on the negative, usually more trouble. But also if we identify with the positive, we often get this puffed up mind. So these are all things which we have, which means they're all things which we can change. So we simply acknowledge the negative thoughts, emotions, behaviors, and have regret and move forward. And acknowledge the positive behaviors, rejoice in those behaviors, and increase them.
Can you define forgiveness?
Generally, in Buddhism, we won't see the word forgiveness. And often, been thinking a lot about why that is, and I haven't really come to a clear conclusion, but I'm feeling that forgiveness somehow a little bit is related to this. Mm-hmm. So in Buddhism we would just have loving kindness and compassion, because to me often when I think about forgiveness it's sort of like, well, he's a bad person, but just forgive him anyway. So, but I'm not sure.
Yeah, because forgive also often comes with forgive and forget.
Yeah.
Or then people say, I'm going to forgive, but I'm not going to forget.
Yeah. So, I mean, you'd have to research, of course, the history of how that word is being used. But I've thought about it quite a bit, and I haven't really come to any clear conclusion, but I'm feeling like that this word somehow in the past has been a little bit associated with this, but I don't know. That's just my personal thinking on the point. So in Buddhism, we have rather, instead of the forgiveness, we have loving kindness and compassion. Okay. So that's the first of the four opponent powers. The second is reliance, or here, foundation, and I think it's listed as the fourth power here. And foundation or reliance is about reaffirming the positive direction that we want to follow in our life. So we're all trying to lead our life on some sort of foundation. And here within the Lamrim, which of course is part of Mahayana, this second power takes on a very specific form. I mean, in general, this would simply be to reaffirm the positive direction of our life. And here within Mahayana, that has really two parts. One is to reaffirm our refuge, our direction in terms of Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. And secondly, to reaffirm the direction or goal of our life. And of course, here in the Mahayana, as we're going to see later, our aspiration is for enlightenment, for the welfare of others. So that is bodhicitta. So this second power would be about reaffirming our refuge in Buddha, Dharma, Sangha and re-establishing this aspiration of bodhicitta. So this, of course, will have an effect of weakening or damaging any negative imprint. The third opponent power is remedy. Here it says applying remedies. And remedies can be many different things. And often it's emphasized that we can make this very practical. For example, let's say we verbally abuse someone at work. Then a remedy, a practical remedy, of course, could be simply to apologize to them. So if we can do some directly positive opposite to it, is best. Sometimes this is not possible or practical. Then it's suggested that to do some positive action with a motivation of wishing to overcome that negative behavior, that can also be very effective. The ultimate remedy, of course, for all negative behavior is that all negative behavior is based on the mental afflictions, which is based on this ignorance, the ignorance, misunderstanding nature of reality. So if we can realize the nature of reality, if we can realize emptiness, then this will wipe out all the negative imprints in our mind. So this is the long-term strategy. So long-term strategy would be to work on this wisdom of emptiness, to study texts that describe this, to reflect on, meditate on, internalize. So this is the long-term strategy, but of course we need a short-term strategy while we're working on the long-term strategy. And a short-term strategy, again, is to have some practical way of doing that. Now, within Tibetan Buddhism, then there are a number of ways that, I haven't done the fourth power yet, but there are a number of ways these four opponent powers are packaged in a practice, a purification practice. Because if purification is to be effective, we need to integrate all four powers in that practice. And you'll be learning and doing one such practice this afternoon, the Venerable Dholma. It's called the Vajrasattva practice. Probably some of you have practiced it already. And this is a purification practice that incorporates all of these four opponent powers. And within the remedy part is involving some visualization, visualizing, purifying the negativities. And also there is some chanting of mantra as well. And you'll be practicing that this afternoon. And Venerable Dholma will be explaining the practice and the various components before you do the practice. So that's all I want to say about that now. She'll explain that this afternoon.
I don't know where I should ask. I've asked this question before. How do you develop faith that the remedy is, that this remedy is effective?
Yeah. So this remedy, of course, if we simply do this practice of chanting some mantra mindlessly, it's not effective. Absolutely not. So we need to make sure that in any purification practice we integrate all four components, meaning having sincere regret, sincerely developing refuge in bodhicitta, and then applying the remedy, and here it's through this visualization process and chanting the mantra. And the fourth point, which we're going to come up to now, is to make a strong determination not to do that negative behavior again. So we need to keep that in mind in any purification practice, that if we don't really sincerely apply all four parts, it's not going to work very well. So to simply think that we can sit down and chant this Vajrasattva mantra a number of times mindlessly and that will purify negativities, I think it's not going to work. It needs to be integrated together. And here too, I think with the visualization, you're visualizing this sort of negativity leaving the body. I think this can be very helpful to overcome. To overcome this, because then we're not identifying ourselves as a bad person anymore. We are imagining at the end of the visualization this purity. So that can be, particularly people who do this a lot, this sort of visualization practice can be very, very powerful, because it can really help stop us from identifying with all these negative aspects of our body and mind. So that certainly can be very helpful. And also, with the chanting the mantra, that often with various mantras, well, in fact, all mantras have a meaning. So it's often good to understand what the meaning of the mantra is when you're chanting it, because then it has more meaning. So that's one point about chanting mantras. Another one, of course, is that at a more subtle level, these mantras are retained in Sanskrit, and these syllables have a certain resonating effect within the subtle energies in the body. So often these mantras, chanting the mantras, can have a very good balancing effect of subtle energies, which means it's balancing the mind as well. So it can have that effect at a deeper level. And of course, often with chanting mantras, it keeps the mind focused. And thereby, we can focus on the visualization and the other powers as well. So it helps with that as well. So there are a number of things, and maybe Venerable Dolma will add a few more this afternoon. Okay. So then the fourth power. Is the power of resolve or restraint. Here it's, I think, translated as, turning away from faults. So what this is, of course, is to make a strong determination not to do that negative behavior again. But here we need to be practical. Because if it's a negative behavior that we do, we have a strong habit, we do a lot, then there's no point saying, I'm never going to do it again. For example, if we're the sort of person that tells quite a lot of lies every day, there's no point in saying, I'm never going to lie again, because you've just told another lie. So if the behavior is a strong habit, then set a time limit and say, okay, for the next hour, I'm not going to do that thing. If that's way too difficult, for the next 10 minutes, I'm not going to do that thing. So pick an amount of time that, with some effort, normally you can manage. Then, over time, you can extend it from 10 minutes to 15 to 30 to 1 hour, 1 day, 1 week, 1 month, the rest of your life. In that way, it's an effective, practical way of breaking particularly strong habits. So these are the four opponent powers that we can apply to purify negative imprints. Now, of course, the best case scenario is to do this immediately after having realized we've done a negative behavior. Immediately have sincere regret, reaffirm our positive direction, think of some sort of practical remedy, and make a strong determination not to do it again. That's the best case scenario. But at least what we can do in a practical way is to do this at the end of each day. Before we go to bed, review our day. How did our day go? And if you engaged in any fairly strong negative behavior, then run through these four opponent powers with respect to that at the end of the day. And so this can be a good way to release a lot of this negativity at the end of the day, because often what happens is if we're caught up in a lot of negativity, particularly at work, our minds are sort of churning over, and we can't even sleep because our mind is so agitated. So this is a good way of then dealing with that and releasing it, and also then it can help a little bit better with transitioning into sleep. Also, I think very helpful here is to focus on the positive. Because as I already mentioned, in our society, we're so much focused on the negative. We're completely out of balance, and we're not only focusing on the negative, we do that with cognitive fusion. So it's a disaster. In fact, recently I read a study that talked about this very phenomenon. And it said, you know, normally if you're with a partner and you do a certain level of negative behavior of a certain strength, you would think to cancel that, you would do the equivalent positive opposite, to cancel. No, doesn't happen. Studies have shown that if you do a certain level of negative behavior with your partner, you need to do equivalent 4 or 5 positive actions to cancel the effect of that. That's how much we're focusing on the negative. So I think it's important at the end of the day to focus on the positive, but again, not with cognitive fusion. So review the day. How did the day go? And any really good things we did during the day is rejoice, not in ourselves, in our behavior. So rejoice in our behavior and make a strong determination to continue to do that good behavior the following day. I think this is very important in our modern society. Otherwise, we're always focusing on the negative. And with cognitive fusion. So no wonder we have so much low self-esteem and guilt and self-hatred in our modern society. So this can help to overcome that. So these are four opponent powers. Any questions? Otherwise, we'll go back in the karma presentation. So again, the key point in any purification practice is to integrate these four points and do them in a way that you find effective. Again, if you simply are mindlessly reciting a few mantras, hoping that's going to purify your negative behavior, I think it's not going to work. You really need to apply these four principles. And of course, if you find that doing that in the context of a visualization and mantra recitation is effective, do that. If you don't find it effective, use another method. Yeah?
I got a question about the mantras. I've heard people like really going through really fast, and I know you're talking about the resonant energy of them. Is it important more for the accuracy or the speed or quantity or the quality? Or
as I already mentioned about meditation, but quality over quantity. Again, unfortunately, we have in a number of the Tibetan traditions, we have this thing called nungdro, preliminary practices, you know, to before we get into the main practices. And one of them often is this vajrasattva practice. And we are to do it like in a retreat setting, and usually the thing is to do 100,000 of these mantras. And so people often go into this practice and just go as fast as they can. Tick, finish. I think this is not going to work. Of course, if we are reciting them with a little bit of speed, that can help us to remain focused. But just try and think, I've got to do this as fast as possible. We're missing the point. In fact, traditionally, in this purification practice, and I think this is mentioned in the Lamrim text as well, is that the teacher, if they feel that you really have to purify a lot of negativities, they maybe give you this Vajrasattva or some similar practice. But they won't say do 100,000 or whatever. They'll say keep doing it until you have some signs that your mind is being purified. And then in the text it mentions many different signs that you'll have these sort of particular types of dreams and visions that your mind is really being purified. So often the teacher would say keep going until you get that. So then, of course, then there's no rush to do them as fast as possible. So I think this is a better approach. Okay. So let's go back now. Where were we? Go back up to the middle of page 12. We talked about the four principles, and then the next outline is reflecting on the distinctions among the varieties of karma or actions. And the first sentence there talks about, it said, the Buddha, the Bhagavan, summarizing the key points, taught the most obvious or coarse among the virtues and non-virtues as being the 10 paths of virtuous and non-virtuous actions. So then we have a presentation of some of the core negative and non-virtuous and virtuous actions that we should really focus on to really maintain that ethical behavior. And so here we find following this list of what's called the 10 non-virtues. And then a little bit further down we have the 10 virtuous actions. And normally the virtuous actions as here are simply listed as having abandoned the non-virtue. But what I'd like to do is to put together a list of 10 virtues that is framed as the positive opposite. Because I think it's very helpful, because again in our society we're always focusing on the negative. I think it's much more helpful to focus on the positive opposite. Like I think it was Mother Teresa said once, she would never attend an anti-war rally, but she would always attend a peace rally. And I think it's much, and there's, I think it's William James, modern day philosopher, who said, what we attend to becomes our reality. So even if we're attending to not doing this, not doing this, not doing this, I mean, what we're attending to is that thing. That's what our mind is focused on. You know, for example, you know, if we want to give up smoking, I think it's not helpful to think, I don't want to smoke, I want to give up smoking. Because what we're focusing on is smoking. The mind doesn't register the negation. Rather, we should focus on the positive opposite, like, I want a healthy body, I want healthy lungs. That's what we should focus on. So that's what I'd like to do here now, is to put together a list of 10 virtues, which is the positive opposite. Actually, another classic example is, you know, let's say we're at home and we're going out and we have to take some keys with us. You know, how often do we say, don't forget the keys, don't forget the keys, don't forget the keys? What do? We walk out the door without the keys, because all the mind registers is forget, 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 and so we duly do that. So rather than not don't forget the keys, what we should say is remember the keys, remember the keys, remember the keys. So that's what we're going to do. So I'll briefly mention the non-virtue, which is listed here, and then we'll come up with the positive opposite as the virtue. So the non-virtue, the first non-virtue, the first three are physical actions. The first one is killing. So what would be the positive opposite of killing?
Protecting life.
Protecting life is quite proactive. What would be sort of the minimum positive opposite? Yeah, I mean, that'd be great, but if we can't manage that...
Not
no, positive.
Respecting
life. With this non-virtue of killing, then often the question comes up, do you need to be a vegetarian to be a Buddhist? The answer is no. Because with all of these non-virtues, you can try to follow them at many levels. And so with killing, of course, at the most base coarse level, would be to stop, not kill other humans. And of course, normally in our society we do that, we end up in jail. Then the next level would be not to kill animals. And then maybe the next level would be not to do anything that indirectly leads to animals being killed, which would be to become vegetarian. But then, of course, even being vegetarian, we can understand that if we're eating a lot of the dairy products and so forth, animals are being harmed, so let's become vegan instead of vegetarian. But then, of course, if we're eating anything that is grown through pesticides and that, bugs and stuff are killed, so we need to become organic vegan. But then, of course, if we're organic vegan and we're eating anything that's dug out of the ground, worms are being killed, so we better not eat anything that's dug out of the ground. And also, we better not eat any sort of grains or anything, because harvesting will kill lots of bugs. So actually, then, we probably need to become a fruitarian and only eat fruit dropping from trees. But actually, even that probably involves some harm when the fruit hits the ground. So actually, maybe we shouldn't eat anything at all. In fact, if we walk out the door at home, we may step on some bugs, so let's stay in our house and not go outside. But even if we're in the house, we may accidentally swallow a mosquito or fly, so we better put a mask over our face. So when we look at this, the reality is that it's impossible to live a life where zero harm happens. What we should try to do as an individual following this precept is to try to minimize our negative impact on others. So in whatever practical level we can manage, that's what we should do, and we should always try to improve that. But of course, we need to be practical because we need to live. And what we don't want to do, which unfortunately often happens, is take the moral high ground and then condemn people who are not operating at our level. This is another case of cognitive fusion. Rather, what we should do is try to encourage people around us to reduce their harm in whatever way. This is what we should do. So that was just a little bit about the killing. So the second non-virtue here is stealing. So what is the positive opposite of stealing?
Giving.
Again, very proactive. What would be minimum positive opposite?
Respecting others' property.
The third non-virtue here is sexual misconduct, which is defined as any sexual conduct that creates harm. So what would be the positive opposite of sexual misconduct? This one's a little bit more difficult, but
healthy sexuality.
Positive sexual conduct. Honesty.
Ethical.
Mm. I think when we talk about sexual misconduct, it's a lot to do with not respecting others. We're enforcing things onto others. So I think here also something like respecting others or respecting others' boundaries or so forth. I think this can be the positive opposite. So these are the three physical behaviors. Yeah.
I just wanted to see if we could finish. You know, that seems incomplete.
Yeah.
Well, again, it's difficult to. Huh?
Okay, that looks okay.
Oh. The physical is.
Respecting others could maybe fit for all of that. You could just leave it with just one. And I wonder if there's a way we could make that more complete, but it sounds like not.
Maybe respecting others' boundaries.
Yeah.
I mean, it's.
Yeah.
It's not so easy.
It's not. Okay.
When I mentioned this some years ago in the group, it was an Australian guy. As soon as I said, "What's the positive opposite of sexual misconduct?" he goes, "Sexual conduct."
Yeah.
Sorry. I mean, immediately. I mean, no hesitation, straight away.
Since adultery is usually the one or the first one listed as the non-virtue, it seems that respecting vows or commitments would be an important part of
that. Yeah. So again, I think there's a lot of elements in here, and it's probably difficult to condense into a couple of words, but I think you understand. Okay. The next four are verbal behaviours. And here the first one is lying. So what's the positive opposite of lying?
Honesty.
Honesty, telling the truth, yes. The fifth non-virtue here is divisive speech. And divisive speech is defined as any sort of speech where your intention is to divide two people or groups of people, to cause them to move apart. Mm-hmm. So what's the opposite of divisive speech?
Conciliatory speech. Mm. Harmonious speech.
Harmonious, yeah, bringing people together. Then the sixth non-virtue here in the text is translated as offensive speech, or often it's translated as harsh speech. And harsh speech or offensive speech is defined as any speech whereby your intention is to hurt the person by what you say. So what's the positive opposite of harsh or offensive speech?
Kind speech.
Then the seventh non-virtue here is listed, translated as senseless speech, or sometimes translated as idle gossip. So here we're talking about the top ten list from the Buddha, but senseless speech or idle gossip seems quite harmless. Why did it make the top ten list?
We're wasting time.
We waste our life with it. So what's the positive opposite of senseless speech?
Meaningful
speech. So those are the four verbal actions. But of course, if we don't restrain our mental attitudes, then it's hard to have ethical, verbal, and physical behaviour. So we need to address the mental side as well. So we have three here, non-virtues to do with the mental attitudes. The first one here is covetousness, the non-virtue. This is defined as wanting something belonging to someone else. So what is the positive opposite of covetousness? And here I think I can think of two things, related things.
Contentment.
Being content with what we have.
Generosity or sympathetic joy.
Exactly. Is being content with what we have and then rejoicing in others' good fortune. The ninth non-virtue here is malice, or sometimes translated as ill will. And this is the mind which has the intention to harm someone. So what would be the positive opposite of malice or ill will, the intention to harm?
Intention to benefit.
Which is, what do we normally use the words in Buddhism for that? Loving kindness and compassion, yes. And then the tenth non-virtue is wrong view. There are a number of wrong views. Particularly here, what is emphasized is the wrong view, thinking there are no consequences to my actions. I can do whatever I want. So what's the positive opposite of wrong view?
Right view.
Right view, or we could say wisdom.
Is it only about the law of cause and effect?
there are other things as well mentioned here, but this is the main one, because it's if we don't, the one that's main one that's emphasized, because if we don't, if we have this wrong view, then of course we'll do all of the other non-virtues, because it doesn't matter. So that's the one that's the sort of the key one here. Of course, when we look later, then the key wrong view at the deeper level, because here we're only talking really about ethics. At the deeper level, the wrong view is the wrong view of reality, you know, grasping onto independent me, independent world. But here, for the basis of ethics, then the wrong view we're interested in is the one that there's no consequences to our actions. So these are the three, then, mental behaviours. So I think to have these 10 virtues, this list as a basis for our ethical lifestyle, I think it could be quite a good list to try and follow. Okay, so that's the 10 virtues. There's a couple more things to mention here about these actions. So if we go down to the next outline just below those 10 non-virtues, and this comes, I think, related to one or two questions earlier, is the distinctions of weight. You know, what makes an action heavy? And there are a number of things mentioned here. It says there are five causes which make an action weighty. Attitude, of course, means that your attitude or motivation, like if you have like a strong, if you engage in a non-virtuous behavior with strong anger or hatred, then that makes it more heavy, of course. Performance is, again, if you are harming someone and you're torturing them, that's more heavy. The absence of an antidote, again, is if you don't then regret the action, then that will also mean that it will be more heavy. Clinging to the perverse, I think, maybe I'll check this in the book, I think this is like thinking that the action is okay, you know. Sorry? I think it's including that as well. I'll just check. Oh, no, this is like, it's a little bit related, but the example they give here is clinging to the perverse is like thinking like animal sacrifice is a good thing, you know, that unfortunately still happens in some countries, you know, to purify my negativities, I need to slaughter a few animals. That's clinging to the perverse. And the last one is the basis. Here, the basis, I can't remember whether that's with us. I think that's with respect to the object that we're doing the action towards. Yeah, but that's also, I'm not sure, because in the next outline it mentions that. So let me just check that again. Yeah, it's to do with, like, you know, killing a person versus killing a mosquito. Then the next one is what makes, and this is a little bit related to that, is what makes things a powerful action. Recipient, again, I think this is in terms of, it mentions here things like the teacher or the parents or so forth, that if we do that action towards them because they have benefited us so much, that makes the action more powerful. Support means that there's a big difference between engaging, for example, in a harmful behavior, knowing that it's a harmful behavior, and not knowing. So, of course, if you engage in a harmful behavior knowing it's a harmful behavior, that is has more weight. than if you sort of ignorantly are engaging in negative behavior. It's not as heavy as if you know it's bad and you still do it. Then the objects, in terms of here it talks about what sorts of, it uses the example of giving here, that it's more powerful to give advice and guidance to others in the spiritual path than simply giving some material things to them. That can prove more powerful action. And then again, the attitude, the same as before, that the motivation or attitude is one of the key elements in any action that will make it very powerful. So that are a few things that talk about the weight or heaviness of our actions. Any questions about that? Okay, then the next outline here is talking about what types of results can we expect from our actions. And here there are three sections, but we can sort of, actually we can leave it as three. There are three types of results that we can have from our actions. The first one here, which I think is listed second here, causally concordant effects, is that we can have a result similar in type to the cause. And that can be in two ways. That we can have a similar experience, meaning the example we gave earlier, if we steal something, then a result of that can be that we have a similar experience of in the future seeing something being stolen from us. And another result similar in type to the cause is we can, by doing an action, we develop a similar habit. That if we start stealing, of course, then a result of that is that we develop the habit of stealing. So I think this is fairly obvious. And then the second one is environmental result. Yes, mentioned here, the third one, environmental effects. And so that is that how we experience the environment around us is also determined by our actions. And we can sort of know this at a very simple level. For example, you know, if we're caught up in anger, then the world around us doesn't look very pleasant. But of course here we're talking about the result, but it's sort of similar idea to that, is that how we perceive the world is also a result of our actions. And then the third one, and how they translate it here, is fruitional effects. Sometimes it's translated as fully ripened effect or result. And what this is talking about is the fact that we have a human existence is the fully ripened result. Meaning that the fully ripened result is an existence, an entire existence itself. And we're going to look at how this works, I think tomorrow it comes up, when we look at the whole death-rebirth process. In that, as we're going through the death process, then one karmic imprint in our mind will ripen to determine what type of life we have in the future. And that future life that is the result is this result. So the fact that we're a human now is the fully ripened result of a previous action from a previous life. And of course, within this life, we are having all of these types of experiences. We're seeing the environment a certain way, we have certain habits, certain experiences. Yeah.
What does it mean in the text by the great forms of the ten virtues, the medium forms and the small forms?
I think that's talking about in terms of attitude mainly, yeah. You know, doing some small action, motivation, medium and strong motivation. Any questions about these types of results? Yeah.
Are there other examples of fully ripened results that occur within a lifetime? Or is it just referring to that context of...
Thank you for that question, because that leads me into exactly the next presentation. I think you're reading my mind. So if we go to page 14, we'll give you an answer. So if you go to the top of page 14, there's an outline there, or a little bit down. It says a presentation of other classifications of karma. The first is distinction between projecting and completing karma. So projecting karma is the action that's going to lead to this result. Completing karma is then all the actions that result in all of our experiences within a life. So projecting karma leads to a life itself, and completing karma is then all the actions that ripen within that life to determine the experiences. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay. While we're on that topic, then there's... the next point, which I think also came up a little bit earlier in one of the questions, was karma whose result will definitely only possibly experience. If in that section there, in the middle of the paragraph, it says, from the viewpoint of the time at which you experience a result, there are three types of certainty. Meaning that if we do an action, when can we likely experience the result? Here it says there are three possibilities. Either we experience that result later in this life, or in the immediately following life, or sometime later. What determines how quickly something ripens? A number of factors, but as we've seen just previously, the key factor is the strength or power of the action. The stronger the action, the more quickly it will ripen in general, as a generalization.
What does it mean consciously done and accumulated, or consciously done and not accumulated?
Oh, that's a bit technical. there's four possibilities here, so maybe we can leave that out. Don't worry about it. It gets quite technical, and I think we don't really need to worry about that here. I mean, if you want, you can read up on it in the book later. Okay. Any questions? I think I've more or less covered the topics I want to cover in the karma presentation. So any questions about... anything we've covered, and then otherwise we'll go for some lunch.
I was going to cover the karma thought one, like the thought creates negative karma. You know, we were talking about it, just if you have a negative thought.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Karma somebody.
Yeah. Okay. Sure. Okay. Yeah. Sure. So here, then, see, in every moment, there are two things going on. There's the result, the experience. And then how we respond to that. So that experience of a negative thought come up is a result. But then, of course, it depends what we do with that. If we then identify with that, grab hold of that and go with it, then we create mental karma. And the more we do that, of course, the stronger the imprint. Yeah.
go over the projecting karma and complaining karma again?
Okay. And we're going to look at this also in more detail when we talk about the death rebirth process. But again, to summarize, is that at the end of this life, as we're going through the death process, then basically we are grasping and clinging to life itself. And that will cause a karmic imprint to become activated. That karmic imprint is going to determine what the future life is going to be, what type of life. So that's the projecting karma. Then when that future life then begins, then within that life we have lots of experiences, and the completing karma is all those actions which will result in all the experiences within a life. So projecting karma leads to a life, completing karma leads to all the experiences within that life. But again, that sort of process of projecting how it works, we're going to cover in some, I think tomorrow in some detail, the whole death rebirth process. It's coming up in the Lam Ring.
I have a question about purification.
Sure.
Does when you're putting imprints of purification, like the regret and the remedy and that sort of thing, the seeds that are already planted, the imprints that are already in the mind, they don't ripen because you're sort of creating all these other conditions, the positive conditions, and that's why those seeds don't ripen? Or until you realize emptiness and then the seeds are cut. Is that correct?
I didn't quite catch the first part of that. So,
okay.
Say
so
again.
We have a negative imprint that we put on our mind,
right,
from our negative karma.
Yeah.
And then we do the four opponent powers.
Right.
So we put all these positive imprints in. These regret for the action and all those things. Now, the actual action of keeping that negative, purifying that, keeping it from ripening, until we get a direct realization of emptiness, until then, those opponent powers work by keeping the conditions for that seed to ripen from happening?
Both that, but more importantly, weakening the imprint.
Okay, so that does have a direct on the imprint.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Again, is there a categorical difference between a thought or feeling on one hand and an intention on the other hand? I mean, can a thought or feeling of aversion or dislike or hatred, is that karma?
So again, within any experience, we have all these mental factors present. And so we have the various mental afflictions present, but also there's a mental factor of intention. So the actual experience is a result, and then what we do with that experience, then we have some intention coming often when we have some experience. We react or respond. So that intention is creating new karma. Not really. It's like, of course, what often happens though is that when something comes up, we grab it and identify and follow. Then we have intention kicking in, and then we're starting to create new karma. So that's why this sort of shamatha practice of simply observing the mind can be very helpful for that, because to stop reacting, because every time we react, of course, we're strengthening the habit and we're planting new seeds. So we want to, you know, that's why often with mental afflictions, there are, of course, practices, positive opposite practices like purification practices or, you know, loving kindness versus anger and so forth. But one of the practices, of course, that is effective is simply observing these mental afflictions and not starting that process of intention and new imprints and so forth and increasing the habit.
So every time that we don't react, like this thought pops up and we don't react, say if it's like an eight worldly concern thought, and then we're weakening that. And
yeah, I mean, because we're not increasing this. So that's what you'll find is that because we're not reacting, we're not creating the habit. which means the habit will get weaker because we're not feeding it.
So I asked earlier, are we moving towards people get what they deserve?
Oh, okay, yes, good question. Okay. So again, then that's an example of cognitive fusion. So if, and unfortunately people use karma to say exactly this, you know, well, they obviously deserve it. But again, this is cognitive fusion, isn't it? So everyone wants to be happy. Everyone wants to be free of suffering. And we're all striving for that. But of course, we have mental afflictions, which is causing us to create actions which lead to suffering for ourselves and others. So rather than when we see someone suffering, rather than fusing the person with their behavior, we should see that they are suffering because of harmful behavior and therefore have compassion for the person and try and help the person to overcome the negative behavior rather than they're a bad person, they deserve to suffer.
So, a follow-up. I understand what you're saying.
And, sure.
But my next stumbling block, which gets back to some of the discussion from the first day, is there is suffering that has external causes. And my
external conditions.
Okay.
Sure.
So my example is where we heard this rhetoric of they deserve it, is say around Katrina. And then I brought this up in my discussion group as well. There was also that rhetoric in the 80s when AIDS first came up, and you know, this is the punishment for this wrong behavior, right?
Yeah. So
So if in the Katrina example, you know, I certainly believe that the people harmed by Katrina did not deserve it.
No one deserves anything.
Right. So what
conditions, causes and conditions. I mean, the fact is, we live in this world where there are many conditions that will lead to physical suffering for us.
Right.
Does that mean we're bad people? No. Again, there's no such thing as a bad person. There's only people who sometimes engage in bad behavior or good behavior.
But there are also those conditions that are external that are different from the mental afflictions that are internal, right? But the external conditions can still cause a bad experience.
Not cause, be a condition. It's the same as like the example before. You know, sometimes when we get angry, we say, that person is the cause of my anger. They made me angry. Not possible. They can be a condition for anger to arise. Yes. But the seed of anger is the cause. So similarly, these external environment can be the condition for a lot of physical suffering. Absolutely. Absolutely. For sure. Yeah. So that's the difference between cause and condition, like the seed and the plant. What's the substantial cause and what are the cooperative conditions? And we need both in any situation for a result.
So what's the cause for physical suffering in the Katrina example?
Is the mental afflictions and actions that they precipitate. So what we need to do, remember, is that also within the continuum of the mind, if this is our life, yeah, is that at the end of our life, whatever imprints we have in our mind that haven't been ripened, they continue. Mm-hmm. So the implication of that is when we come into this life, our mind is full of billions of imprints. Billions. What they are, we don't know. We inherit them. So, therefore, I think if pretty well any one of us gets in the way of a car coming down the road, we're going to be hurt. Does that mean somehow we're all bad people because we're hurt? No. It means that the conditions have come together. We've got billions of imprints in our mind. And so, again, rather than doing the cognitive fusion, rather we should have compassion for anyone who's experiencing suffering. Because otherwise it just, like you said, becomes a blame game. And then we've missed the point. We've missed the point. Because everyone is trying to be happy, trying to be free of suffering. And we should have that correct perspective.
And unless we are an enlightened being, we will have negative imprints.
Everyone does.
One of us, of course.
Of course. Right. And remember, one of the principles of karma is the increase. So even if we, you know, even if we do a lot of small negative things, but we're happy to do that, we keep doing it, we can get a big result. So we shouldn't think that, you know, we're some hugely evil person if we have some suffering experience. This is just the causes and conditions coming together. And again, we need to avoid this cognitive fusion, because otherwise it's a blame game. And what this actually implies is that we are the masters of our future, you know, because we have, with cognitive ability, to be able to plant new and different imprints to have a different future, but it's up to us. So it's personal responsibility. This is how we should see this principle. This principle implies personal responsibility. We run over time. Maybe we'll leave it there, otherwise, because I have to give the discussion questions. So then maybe you can ask some more questions in the session after in this afternoon. In fact, the first question is relating to the question we just covered. And there's a whole big discussion about this that you might like to talk about, the whole free will destiny thing. So does karma imply that we have no free will, that everything is predetermined? Does karma imply that we have no free will, that everything is predetermined? The second question is about these four opponent powers, and the question is, discuss practical ways of overcoming negative habits using the four opponent powers. So discuss practical ways of overcoming negative habits using the four opponent powers. And in that second question, the second part, I think it would be good also to discuss regret versus guilt. And the third question is, can we engage in these Lam Rim practices without believing in rebirth? Can we engage in these Lam Rim practices without believing in rebirth?